VicAss is brought to you by people like yourselves that are going to patreon.com, patreon.com/thefitcast. And there you can support the show starting at just $1 per episode. And with that $1 per episode, I'm going to make sure new episodes get produced every single week and out to your iTunes feeds. Everyone that is supporting the show through Patreon is actually getting the show 1 week early. So if you're jumping on there and supporting the show, you're going to get those episodes a week early and without any pre-roll stuff. It just goes right into the show. As we go into the new year, I just want to really say thank you to everyone that has been supporting the show. And also, if you can, if you thought about it, I would love if you could help out going forward, just because we've had some people drop off. And if you're concerned, you can always cancel your contribution anytime. But really, like I said, if you've been listening to the show for a long time, I'd really appreciate you, you know, giving back and hopefully helping out with the show. Like I said, really for about $4 a month, you can make sure that the show keeps going. And that's less than a standard cup of your famous brand coffee, which I don't want to throw under the bus. So thank you, as always, to people that are supporting the show. And it's super easy to do. Like I said, you just go to there, patreon.com/thefitcast. Use your credit card, and you can even support the show through PayPal. If you go to thefitcast.com, there's a PayPal tab on the left-hand side. Any bit, you know, it would be greatly appreciated. But like I said, I would hope you guys will help us out going forward and making sure great new people come to you every single week to answer your fitness, nutrition, rehab questions, things like that. So thank you for me, Kevin Larrabee. And without further ado, let's get into the show. Hello and welcome back to the FitCast. This is episode number 317. How did I not make a Stone Cold 316 reference for last episode? I don't know, but I'm back, Kevin Larrabee, and along with me is the still in the desert and still a pain in the ass, but talking about pain, Jonathan Fast. John, what's up?
That was a nice segue right there.
I was trying to think, like, yeah, how could
pain in the ass talks about pain? That's good.
That's what I was going to try to do, but you know, it was really great. We did episode 313, and you did like a brief introduction. Really, I mean, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to this subject, yeah. And it actually got me a lot more interested in the subject when you discussed it, I guess, three or four episodes back. But we wanted to get back together because there was some great feedback from the audience. It seemed like you guys really enjoyed it, and one of the big things that we're going to be talking about today is clinical application to a lot of the stuff that John talked about. So I will say, before we go forward, I want you to take a second, go back, listen to 313, and then come into this one. And even if you did, you might want to go back and get like a quick refresher before we come back and go into this one, just so you have some context to some of the stuff John was talking about. But I'm going to help you guys out anyways, in case you are not going to do that, or you want a refresher on yourself, or just for yourself. John, let's just take a step back. And first, two questions for you. How the hell did you get interested in this subject? And then B, you know, for people that didn't listen, or they listen and they just want a quick refresher and they're short on time, why is this subject so important, and why should it be brought up?
Okay, well,
I know that's a lot right there, but I think, yeah, you know, just for the safety of the audience.
Well, I think that there are probably three kind of focal points in my personal interest here. One, as a physio, this is what we deal with, right? Everyone that we see has some type of pain in one way or another. Most of the time, that's a physical pain. Sometimes it's this type of, I guess, activity pain, like this idea that they're not doing something well, and that's a pain. That's an emotional pain. I want to do something better. I have a current pain emotionally, if we think about it in those terms. So as a physio, you kind of, if you're not interested in the concept of pain in one way or another, you're probably in the wrong profession. So that was an underlying type of theme. But then I've had two main interactions with patients, but that kind of sits on top of this entirety of patient experiences. A lot of times that we, as physios, we're always going to encounter patients that for one reason or another we can't help the way that we want to. And I think a lot of times it falls into this arena of pain science itself, as something that we may not be entirely comfortable with or understand. And I don't think that this is stuff that many physio programs really get into deeply, or at least as deeply as they possibly could. We learn about pain, we learn about mechanisms, but we probably don't pursue it to levels that would be necessary to in order to help people that experience chronic pain syndromes and conditions. And that's a large percent of the people we see. So I had a patient that came to me as pretty much an acute case. He was a basketball player having some difficulty with like a groin hip flexor pain. A couple sessions and he was good to go. And he actually got signed for an Asian team. He was here in Saudi Arabia actually. And he got signed for an Asian team. It was like his first professional contract and he was stoked. But when he came back, he had this tremendous amount of pain that it basically reoccurred because of the play schedule and the demanding schedule that he had. And he went to see a surgeon here by the request of his uncle, who's like a family friend. And the surgeon basically blew his mind away, took imaging, saw this massively herniated disc that had nothing to do with any pain complaint that he had. And more to the point, he never would have known it was even there. I mean, his back did not bother him. The hip problem was not related to his back. It was just completely secondary finding. And yet the discovery of this disc herniation sent his pain through the roof, and basically trying to figure out why that had happened when he came back to me sent me into this process of trying to discover, okay, how did this happen? Why is he now suddenly in pain where he can't stand, he can't sit, he can't get out of bed, he's waking up in the middle of the night, something that had just not happened before. So by researching this and learning more about what pain actually is and how this can happen to someone kind of set me into motion. And then ultimately my own wife has had experiences with chronic pain for years. So, you know, when we began a relationship and now living with someone that has had chronic pain, it really, I mean, if there's a personal motivation there, I don't know what is, you know, I mean, it's just the trying to understand my wife better, trying to understand her experiences better. And in turn, therefore understanding the experiences of my own patients in a clinic, all of that kind of came together for me. So it's something that I personally find interest in. It's something that, to me, as a physio, chronic pain is such a widespread condition, costs our economy billions and billions and billions of dollars every year, yeah. Emotional suffering type of pain. And I remember when I decided to become a physio, the one thing that it always sort of – it didn't bother me, but it occurred to me that the decision between medical school and physical therapy school, it was almost a no-brainer. I mean, I kind of went into med school concept for a little bit, but then came back to physical therapy because it really was, this is what I was meant to be. But the one thing that occurred to me was the idea that as a physical therapist, I will probably never save someone's life, right? I'm not going to have them on the table and cut out something bad or fix their heart or, you know, whatever, and actually save someone's life. And it was just something that sort of, you know, geez, that would be something, you know, kind of personally very amazing to experience that unfortunately I'll never be able to do. But with pain and chronic pain, I realized that that probably was something that I would be able to do, because it's not necessarily that chronic pain will kill someone, but the idea of giving someone back their lives from this daily suffering to being able to enjoy, explore, and live life without pain is at least as valuable as actually saving someone's life. And so that's also a very personally meaningful thing to me, that through – if the more I study, the more I learn, and the more that I learn to help others, the type of impact that you can have to help other people, to me, is irreplaceable and an unbelievable feeling.
Maybe I will be taking another step back. But you know, from the last episode when we started talking about this stuff, I think one of the things that almost intrigued me the most is that it seems like for the most part, a lot of the research that you guys are using in terms of talking about this stuff is relatively new. So this whole, I guess, subset of research is relatively new. Is that correct?
Well, no, it's not actually. That's what's amazing, that the research that we bring up probably, you know, for posting on Facebook or whatever, that's new stuff that's coming out. But this, the study of pain and pain science has been going back, well, the integration of the brain to pain goes back 50 years. So that was the gate control theory by Wallen Melzack, and that was something like 1962, 64, something like that. So we're looking at 50 years. The concept of the neuromatrix, which I actually wanted to bring up today, that was I think 1989. So we're looking at 20 years of the type of stuff that I kind of briefly talked about on the last episode. But this stuff has really been looked into for 50 years.
I was gonna say, like, it seems like not just this, but there's a lot of subjects in our industry that tend to have been researched for a long time, but we tend to not necessarily go back and look at the research. We're just looking at the stuff that is coming out today. So so you're saying usually the, you know, primarily the research is in the last 50 years, starting from the mid 60s going to today.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, we, in other words, this was what was called in there's in philosophy of science, there's something called a paradigm shift. And so the argument is that in these paradigm shifts, science doesn't progress like this linear thing of we just keep in, you know, finding out more and more things. The idea is that there are ultimate paradigm shifts. These are where our great theories come from. So you think about, you know, the idea of Einstein was a paradigm shift in our
relativity,
understanding of So it changes everything within the field. So I would call these moments, the idea of gate theory and then the idea of the neuromatrix, paradigm shifts, where it changed everything that we thought about in this subject and then started the field in a new path. So that's kind of what we're in right now. We're in this paradigm of the neuromatrix biopsychosocial theory. It doesn't necessarily mean that there will be something that completely changes the way that we look at it in the future, but there may very well be. I mean, that this is appears to be what the history of science is kind of about. So right now, this is where the interest looks into. We look into clinical applications of working with people in pain, as well as just defining what the mechanisms are so that we can better treat it through either pharmaceuticals or clinical or surgical or whatever the case may be. So it's just changed the direction, the path, the way that we look at this problem.
Okay. So for people out there that, you know, I like to read books. Now I like to have like all this stuff like in a neatly, you know, package. Like I'm all for looking at research papers when Alan Aragon's research review comes out, or if you guys do something on your podcast. But you know, for me personally, to digest a lot of this stuff, I'd rather just have it already digested than almost regurgitated in a, you know, edible format. You know, mother bird to you know, little bird fashion. If that's, that makes any sense. But I was wondering, is there any like books out there that people can take a look at? I know there's been some articles that, that you've actually put together, but are there any books out there that you'd recommend on the subject that people just want to dive in, but not necessarily go into a like a textbook level of content?
Yeah, well, actually, there are three books. Let me actually pull up the exact name of this one.
But this is just kind of off the cuff. I kind of threw this down at the last.
There are three books I think that make some very good entry level sort of understanding of pain without going into.
Let me pull up Amazon.
Okay,
I want to order some books. All right,
good man. That's why I want to get the first one, because I think I'll put it in like order of, let's say, difficulty.
Let's start with easy to hard.
The easiest one is probably. There's a book called Painful Yarns, and that's right. Is that what it is? Painful Yarns. Yeah, and that's a really nice, very easy book to understand.
Paperback book from 2007, cost $16 bucks on Amazon.
Right, so that's very easy. It talks about, these are just stories that explain basic pain concepts. It's a really great book, not only to kind of understand some of these concepts and a little bit with examples, but also to teach others about it, which is absolutely valuable when you're trying to explain these things. If someone is having difficulty in understanding it, it doesn't do them any good. So Painful Yarns is a way to kind of communicate some of these concepts, and it's a very simple type of book to understand.
And if you're driving, I'll put these all in the show notes for the episode, so it's all make sure they're all in there. But yeah, no, it's a – okay. I got one click. All right, there we go.
The Pain Chronicles was from Melanie Thernstrom. I love this book. It's her experiences with chronic pain, but she's a journalist. So what she did is she basically wrote a book not only about her own experiences, but overall this concept of pain science and what we now understand. It goes through the history of pain, where we are today, you know, experiences, you know, why we think this, why we think that. What I love about that book is that it gives us this kind of look into a person's life experiencing chronic pain and the difficulties that they may face, the challenges. You know, as a clinician, if we don't understand our patients and pain, like we talked about last time, pain is a personal experience. So the more that you can understand how some people experience pain and what that does to them, their lives, their loved ones, their entire world, it is so invaluable. And this book was fantastic for that reason.
Well, it's just to pause for a second. This one is also available on Amazon. We're obviously using the United States version, but you can actually get it on. This is available on Kindle as well for about $9, and they have an Audible version. So if you have either of those, that's a good way to do it. I think I don't know, man. Should I go Kindle or Audible?
I loved the Audible version. Oh, okay. The reader was fantastic. It's up to you, but I mean, it is an engrossing book. It's fascinating, and
the
amount
for the car ride. All right.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a wonderful book. Wonderful book.
And purchased. Oh man. Cool. Okay, this is good. This is personally fulfilling for me, and hopefully for the audience too.
The next one is, of course, Explain Pain. This is like the standard introductory text for anyone. That was by Lorimer Mosley and. Butler. That's right. Lorimer Mosley and David Butler co-authored it. This is also a fairly easy thing to understand. It does go into some depth.
Okay.
But it's designed – actually, it was originally designed for patients. It's the type of book you would have like in your waiting room, and it's like, here, read this and understand everything about yourself. So it's a really, really, really nice book. Again, lays out the foundations of what we kind of understand at this point.
Sorry, this is a really unprofessional, but I'm buying Audible books and buying great. All right, so that's literally downloading to my phone right now. So okay, so just from looking at these two books, I think for me, if I'm looking at these three right now, the one that is standing out to me in terms of like most appealing is probably the Pain Chronicles.
Yeah, it's a really nice that one. What Pain
Chronicles? It's like a happy medium between like you said, like Painful Yarns, which is a little bit more of like I wouldn't say entertainment, but like even the description says these stories, while entertaining, are used as metaphors to explain key aspects of biology of pain. Painful Yarns is the perfect pre-read for Explain Pain. So that is you know, great way that you set it up. So that is going to be like your 101. Damn it, I'll just buy all of them. I don't care.
There is one more if that I think is a good entry-level kind of text.
Okay.
Which is Therapeutic Neuroscience Education.
Okay.
That's by Lowe and Puentedera. And that's a little bit more detailed. It's going to go into the science, endocrinology, neuroscience. So it's more detailed. It's a very good book for clinicians. Mm-hmm. I would stop there. There are many more, but I think those books, if you read all four of those books, you'd have a very quality understanding of clinical applications of pain and what it means and why it's important.
Okay. So I'm going to align it again for everyone. So we're talking, Painful Yarns, which runs at about, $17. And that would be like your 101, the Pain Chronicles, which is about, $11, or you can get an Audible version if you have one of those accounts. And then you have Explain Pain, which runs – that's a little bit more in terms of your, you know, your clinical side or like your classroom type text, which is going to run you about $85. So that's like more –
Well, there is, yes, but if you know what, if you look it up, I think it's – explainpain.com or something like that.
Okay.
You can get a download for a lot less.
Okay. Then that is another way you can do it. I'm trying to look and see. Yeah, right now there's a Kindle version, you're correct, for $35.
Yeah.
So, you know, less than half of that. So I'll make sure links for all this stuff will be in the show notes. But just in case you want to get this stuff going right now, those are three. Damn, maybe I'll just buy this too. All right, I'm going to start with this is what I'm going to do. Personally, I'm going to start with the first two that you mentioned. And then, if you know, I'm still like, yeah, I need more, then Explain Pain will be the one that I go to. But now for me these days, I need it to be really not like fluffily written. But man, like if I open up, you know, I'm not going to name books, but there's certain books you just open up that are really good for this profession, but like two pages in, you're just knocked out.
Right, right.
You're just out cold.
I think that those two are good. And what I like about the Pain Chronicles is it really goes into not only the importance of this stuff, because it's fine to read painful yarns and whatever, but it doesn't convey the importance of this information, but it also talks about the difficulties. You know, it's the difficulty of treating this. This is not a completely understood phenomenon, the idea of chronic pain and how to treat it. Some people get better, most not. And it's one of these premier challenges of our time. So that's what I like about Pain Chronicles, is you'll really understand just how, you know, demanding and important this area of research and medical practice is, because it is the forefront of medical challenge today.
Yeah, super, super interesting stuff. Okay, so I pulled this off course there a little bit, but maybe that is you know, some extra stuff that people can check out if you do have a more thirst for this stuff afterwards, especially if you're listening to a podcast. That Audible version is going to be probably the way to go. That might be your next step, man. All right.
Yep.
These are expensive. Like, these are expensive episodes. Whenever I talk to you or like Tom Venuto, it ends up being kind of expensive. So, okay. Let's talk about, let's get back to the subject on hand. So, you did have a little bit of an information dump as an intro to, pain science last week, but, you know, one of the things that we were talking about off the air is, you know, people are like, all right, well, whatever. Like, I don't get it. So how does this, you know, really affect me, whether it's someone that is, you know, the weekend warrior, which I always think is a terrible way to, you know, summarize someone that likes to train 3 days a week, 4 days a week at their local gym. But, you know, for them, and also, you know, for people that want to apply some of this stuff, because as a personal trainer, at the most basic level, you're going to be having people come in with low back pain, people with knee pain, people with, you know, shoulder pain. Those are going to be like usually the three major things that we see when we get a new client, because they're untrained, they have a, you know, sedentary lifestyle, they have a desk job, and those are the three things that usually pop up. So I wanted to ask you, with all that stuff being said, and I just really gave you a lot of questions, but, you know, how is this stuff going to apply to them? And or maybe the better question is, how can they apply some of this information into those environments to make sure that, you know, they are, you know, making the best, you know, course of action when it comes to those?
Right. I think what's very valuable, and I mentioned it, the pain neuromatrix. So this is this concept that Dr. Melzack, who's one of the like godfathers of modern pain science, literally gave us. It makes this more understandable, I think, the basics of this concept, because what I personally hear a lot from therapists or people that work with patient populations is, oh, okay, well, this stuff is really interesting, but it doesn't mean anything, right? I still do whatever I do and it doesn't matter. And that is entirely untrue. I mean, it just couldn't be further from the truth. What it does is it complements and enriches your practice by, you know, kind of taking a step back and looking at all the ways that pain can be influenced and can affect an individual. And that's what the neuromatrix basically is. So what the neuromatrix explains to us is how the inputs that contribute to the concept of pain, but also the outputs, which are at least as valuable. So on the input side of things, we have this, it's cognitive related brain areas. What that means is that whenever that experience is fueled by our memories of a past experience, right? So if I have back pain today, what what memories of back pain do I have from previous episodes or from family members that may have had pain? What imagery does that conjure up? What is my attention to that back pain? Am I doing something currently, or am I just sitting around doing nothing? Right. So our attention it's the example of if I'm running across the street and I sprain my ankle, but there's a bus coming, I probably don't experience pain at that very moment, because if I were to drop and suddenly grab my ankle, I'm going to get run over by a bus. So the experience of pain is not helpful in that circumstance, which is why every horror movie where the girl is running through the woods and then she sprains her ankle and drops to the ground and then the killer gets her wouldn't happen. It wouldn't actually happen. It'd be unlikely to happen. That's why you get soldiers that are shot and wounded and don't even know about it until they're after the battle, because at that point, their attention was somewhere else that was much more important and vital than attending to a flesh wound, you know. So these things are inputs. Sensory systems. So these are the biological, your skin, the organs, your musculoskeletal inputs. So this is the nerves, and this is what we traditionally think of when we think of pain. It's that physical injury or the information coming from the body itself. And then emotional areas. So this is your limbic system in the brain and your stress response, what's happening in your life, the stress, the environmental cues that are occurring at the time. All three of those things are important, and that this is where we get the term biopsychosocial. So it is not just the physical occurrence of a damage, but rather biological, psychological, and sociological inputs at that time to that individual, which is what makes pain such an individual experience. All three of these things are valuable. All three are important. So to just assume if someone experiences pain, it must be some physical thing is entirely false by this definition and this understanding. The outputs, there are also three outputs that are described. So we have pain, the perception of pain.
John, I'm going to pause you on that for just one second, yeah. And we're going to try to reconnect on Skype. We're having a little bit of issues, so we're going to pause 1 second. Okay. No, I got everything that you have. You just sound a little bit like a robot. So we're going to pause for a second. We're going to be right back with what John was just talking about, the three – I think it was three concepts of what he was
three
talking.
Outputs.
Three outputs. Thank you. Sorry, I'm getting concerned about audio quality. We'll be right back. All right, and I'm going to use this time to say thank you to all the people out there that are supporting the show through Patreon and helping to make sure that the episodes come out each and every week. And for people out there that don't know what this is all about, I mentioned it at the beginning of each episode, but people mentioned that I should probably spell out what this is all about. So you can go to patreon.com/theFitCast, and starting at just $1 per episode, you can help make sure that the episodes are getting produced every week. This way, it turns into more of a job for me to make sure that you guys get new stuff. And, you know, I know everyone out there, I only want you to help support the show if you really feel like you get something out of these episodes and you think they're worth a dollar. And I really hope that you do with the time that goes into producing these and putting them up and the cost of running the website and the bandwidth and all that stuff. So, again, it's patreon.com/theFitCast. And you also get episodes 1 week early. So if you're a Patreon, you get the episodes a week early, and there's no pre-roll stuff, and there's no ads at the start of the show. So thank you, everyone out there. Each and every one of you are seriously incredibly important to making sure that this show keeps going, and you know who you are. So thank you so much. And now back to John.
Oh, my God. Every listener just screamed at their speaker just there. That was like the equivalent of a cliffhanger. It was like, here's the first three, and then it's like, and now let's have a word from our sponsor.
They can hear that the audio quality was getting rough, so we had to reconnect anyways. And I thought it would be a great time to run a mid episode
break,
ad. So
sponsor break, yeah.
But we don't like that's the thing. We don't have sponsors, so
it's
you guys that are listening to the show and you're supporting the show. You're the ones that are actually sponsoring the show each and every week. So we'll say that this episode is brought to you by Tom Venuto, who is a Patreon supporter of the show. So thank you, Tom.
Nice. So just to recap, it was the inputs to any type of pain, human pain experiences, cognitive, so memories and the attention and meaning and anxiety and thoughts and all that stuff, sensory signaling, so these are your nerves, the musculoskeletal, the physical mechanisms of pain, and then the emotion-related brain areas, so how you're feeling, your stress response hormones, all that kind of stuff. So the takeaway of that is that it's more than just a physical damage, right? When we experience pain, physical damage and really the threat of that damage is just one aspect. And this is where we get the concept of biopsychosocial. So moving on, we also have three outputs according to this theory. And the three outputs are perception of pain itself. So obviously when we have either damage or threat of damage, we may experience pain from that, but we don't always. We can have pain without damage. We can have damage without pain. So pain is only one possible output of this system. We can only be aware of pain. So it doesn't. What that means is that we can't have pain and not feel it, right? That doesn't occur. We either have pain and we are aware of it as a conscious experience, or the output was not pain, and that's it.
So you're saying to help people digest this as much as possible, you know, mm-hmm. there can be damage without pain. So you can actually have structural right. issues that are not causing, you know, pain signals to be sent.
Right.
What is an example of that for people out there?
There's a classic study where they looked at they basically took 100, I think it was like 99, asymptomatic. So people without any symptoms of back pain, any history of back pain, nothing. They were fresh off the street. How are you feeling? I feel great. I've always felt great. Mm-hmm. And they ran them through MRI. And what they found was, I believe it was about half, at least half, had major issues to be found. You know, disc issues, fractures of the spine, any number of issues that could be identified. So they just basically gave these scans to the radiologist and said, hey, what would you say is going on here? Mm-hmm. And what that shows us is that structural problems are probably the norm. These were asymptomatic people. These were people without anything. So now imagine that a couple of them develop pain for whatever reason, and then you run through an MRI and they say, see, here's a disc. That must be the problem. But that disc was probably there before they experienced pain. So we can't say that the physical damage, the identifiable damage, is actually a cause of that pain. It may be an input, but so far that input didn't result in a pain experience. There's another study that I find just unbelievable, and it was the same concept run on adolescent elite tennis players. This was a pretty recent study. And I think it was about 30 or so of these tennis players, and they put them through the MRI. They were elite players playing at elite levels, no history of pain, and they found in almost every one of them fractures, disc lesions, and these mm-hmm. are – the average age was like between 17 and 18 years old.
Yep.
Children. These are children that have unbelievable findings on MRI, and they're playing incredibly. Yeah. So,
well, that, I mean, we see this with a lot of overhead athletes. This is a big thing in baseball too, where you'll have pitchers that have had torn labrums for forever and they just never knew.
Right. So that gives us an indication of what this actually means. Damage in terms of physical damage is probably natural, and it is not specifically. We're certainly not looking to get damaged, but we shouldn't be freaking out when something is found on image. And it doesn't mean that it's unimportant. It's certainly important, but we have to put it in its place, meaning that the experience of pain and physical injury are not the same thing. They will sometimes coincide. The you would hope that they would always coincide. So I become aware of physical injury by pain, but it doesn't necessarily end up that way, and it's not necessarily valuable that it always does anyway, because again, the human body heals and adapts. So the idea that we should always experience pain means that every injury is important, but it's not. Not always. You bump your elbow, you get a bruise, and you never felt it mm-hmm. because that bruise just really didn't matter. Yet that is physical damage. That's real physical damage. So putting it as a one-to-one is the problem that we have, and what we'll kind of discuss, if we look back at the neuromatrix, remember that what we think, how the memories of incidents in the past, the attention, the meaning, and the anxiety over that meaning all contribute to our pain experience. So two individuals with the same injury may have a very different output. They may have a very different experience of pain. One may not have pain at all, and the other may be in extraordinary amounts of pain. Mm-hmm. And that is not correlational specifically to the amount of damage or the value of that damage. Right, bumping my knee doesn't really matter, but if I've had an ACL injury in the past and I'm an athlete and my livelihood is dependent on my knees being healthy, there may be an extreme pain experience based on those factors, because now, you know, a knee injury may end my career. So it is, I mean, that's exactly what I would surmise happened to my basketball player. When he saw he had this massive herniation, what goes through his head? It's every image of an NBA player going down with back spasms, right? Every player that had to retire because they couldn't play anymore because of an injury, and his surgeon telling him you can never play again because this herniation is so horrible, you'll never be able to, you shouldn't even be walking, right? Those types of messages are only mean something if physical damage is equivalent and equal to physical threat and to physical pain. But because they're not, messages like that will tend to be more harmful than helpful.
Okay. Now, I want people to go get a drink. Go get a drink, pause, get some coffee, make sure we're on board, because this is when the important stuff is coming. So,
right.
All right, we have a lot of this great information. We have this information, but the important thing for most of the people listening to this show is going to be, all right, how do we take this information and use it to our advantage? So my question for you would be, and we talked a little bit about this on last episode, but just to talk about it a little bit more, you know, how is this information beneficial to us as strength coaches, or as people that, you know, just want to lift and then maybe, you know, after squatting for 3 months, my knee starts bothering me.
Right.
How can we take advantage of this stuff?
Well, the advantage is the outputs here from that neuromatrix. And the first output was possible pain. There are two others. Mm-hmm. There's an action output, right? So that's our voluntary and involuntary movement patterns. So that's the kind of thing where you step on a nail and you automatically lift up your foot. Right, it's an involuntary action, and there's also voluntary actions. I can't bend over because it hurts my back, right? So we have muscle stiffening and tightness as an involuntary action, and then we have the avoidance of movement potentially, which is a voluntary action. This is what we see in our patients and our clients. Now, as a strength coach or a personal trainer, you're very often going to get someone that comes in and in their history, they say, well, you know, I've had back problems or I've had knee problems. Very often that's why they see personal trainers, because they want to get stronger so that they no longer have bad knees. They may have even gone to their medical doctor first and they said, go start exercising, because movement itself is one of the best ways, the best options that we have for dealing with pain syndromes. So, and that is fairly clear throughout the literature, is that movement itself, exercise, is beneficial. So when we evaluate and when we look at these individuals and we find these altered movements and we blame it on weakness, or we blame it on, you know, you're going to develop something that will produce pain, this isn't necessarily true. That action program has probably already changed because of the inputs. And remember, so now let's take a step back for a second. We have these inputs, our beliefs, the biopsychosocial, so the biological issues that may be occurring, psychological beliefs and understanding, and sociological, your environmental understanding. You know, again, like, what does your society deal, how does it deal with pain? How does it deal with illness? Is it a stoic society? Is it a family-oriented society? What are your environmental inputs? When we evaluate someone and we see them moving differently, how do we know that this will lead to something? It may actually just be the expression of whatever that something was. There was a really great study that is part of this you know this family of research that will experimentally induce pain and then look at what happens. And they did this with the SI joint. So they injected a solution to the SI joint causing pain, and then they perform some of these tests that we do in the clinic, straight leg raise, things like that. And what they found was this experimentally induced pain produced the outputs that we would expect to see as what we would possibly take as indicators of future pain, right? So the way that they change their movements and their behaviors are the types of things that we would normally look at and say, oh, this will result in some type of injury, where in fact, it's very possible the injury had already occurred and the only thing that we're seeing is the output, but there's pain.
Okay. So just to clarify, they were injecting fluid that was triggering pain, but the pain that it was triggering was pain that you would get, like almost if you're anticipating an injury.
Let's get an idea. Let's say we see someone lunge.
Yeah.
Okay. And they're lunging, and one leg is great, straight, everything's lined up, and then the other side it falls inwards.
Yeah.
Right. So we would say, oh, well, see, this falling inwards is going to – you're going to have some bad knee pain. You're going to have some damage. We're assuming that the movement is predictive of future damage and pain.
Yeah.
We don't have very good evidence to support that idea. Now, in some situations, yes, if I – you know, things like depth jumps and ACL injury, right? So there are some very consistent standards that we understand may contribute to a future injury, but we can't extrapolate that idea to all injuries. And very often it is not predictive. So there are lots of studies in running form, right? We measure all kinds of variations of movement in running, and yet none of them are predictors of running injury. And it seems kind of wild because you're saying, well, this person's knees fall in, this person runs with their one leg, one side is all screwed up and the other is good. And none of these things are predictive. So certainly not consistently, but many, many times not even within the study itself. So when we see someone moving differently, go ahead and change it. That's fine. But don't start warning them of this idea that future pain is going to occur, that this is dangerous, that this is bad. Because now what you've done is you've contributed to that psychological, the first part of the neuromatrix, the cognitive inputs, by describing movement as being bad. And that contributes ultimately to the potential output of pain as a signal, as an indicator that something is threatening. Pain doesn't necessarily mean that something has gone wrong. It just means that something is potentially threatening. So in the same way that if I walked through a dark alley at night and it was a bad part of the neighborhood and I knew there had been muggings, I'm going to have outputs. It's going to be different than if I'm walking in the middle of the daylight in a field full of flowers, right? I have stress response that changes. My muscles stiffen. I start looking around. I'm more aware of the environment, all because of the concept of a threat. Mm-hmm. Not because someone actually jumped out and mugged me, but because the environmental cues and my historical cues. Well, I've seen bad movies where people get mugged in the alleyway, or I read a newspaper report, or maybe someone in my family or friend circle got mugged. All these things contribute to our output, our stress response. That stress response actually is a third output in the neuromatrix. It's the cortisol and the adrenaline and noradrenaline and epinephrine and all these things that contribute to a stress response are potential outputs as well. So pain may not even occur, and yet you have a change in movement and a change in your stress response and your immune system response. And therefore, there's something going on and you're just not aware because it hasn't reached the position of perception just yet. So when we see someone move in a different way, we can't assume that that's going to lead to anything. And by describing it as leading to something, we're actually priming them to potentially have pain in the future. Because now we've increased that one area of awareness of what does it mean if I move, you know, it either means nothing or it means something very bad. And as trainers and as rehab professionals and medical professionals, we have that role. We can either assure someone that the body is resilient and the body can heal, or we're going to warn them of damage and make the world very dangerous. And if we do that, we've contributed to that individual's understanding of what it means when their knee might fall in or their back rounds a little bit. Most of the time, it means nothing until we give it meaning.
Okay, now this is making a little bit more sense than it did last time. All right, cool.
Right.
Man, it makes me wish we could use more than 10 to 15% of our brains. Maybe we could control this stuff a little bit better.
Yeah, thanks.
Go see Lucy in theaters now if you want some more information on that. Anytime you can go see a Luc Besson film, director and writer of fantastic films like The Fifth Element, you should absolutely do it. Mm. And all the Transporter movies.
Just in case we use all of our brains.
It's a myth. I know. But it's a good theme for a movie.
Actually, in fact, what's interesting about in terms of pain and pretty much most of how we experience things is that a pain, there is no such thing as a pain center. It does use the majority, if not all, of our brain in one way or another because of this multidimensional inputs. Hmm. So when we experience pain, you don't see this one little spot light up. You see entire regions of the brain light up.
Okay. Okay. So we have like maybe five or 10 minutes before we get to wrap up. So, I think we did a really good job hitting on some resources that people can check out. I know we talked about some articles last time. We got some books this time. If you wanted to, maybe the best way to put this is if you wanted to help people in the debate, because it is you guys are fighting the good fight, talking about this stuff and trying to spread information on this these days. What would you kind of say to people out there that are still maybe a little bit unsure if this if this information is valuable or not, or if it's something that they should be listening to?
If we're trying to help people live better, just overall live better, then we having more information at our disposal that is of value to that purpose is itself valuable, right? So if I'm a car mechanic, but the only thing that I know how to do is check the suspension, then someone coming to me with a problem with their engine, I'm of no use, and therefore I'm not fulfilling my role. So for individuals that are looking to help people live better, which should include every personal trainer, physical therapist, chiropractor, medical doctor, whatever, then understanding what I just described basically is in terms of a neuromatrix, in terms of an input and output system, means that you're better, more capable, more aware of the potential contributors and things to look for when someone comes to you with a complaint, an issue of pain, right? It doesn't turn us, physical therapists into psychologists, and it doesn't turn, personal trainers into physical therapists. That's not the point here. The idea is that by educating, by explaining the experience that an individual is going through, by being aware of the fact that if my client says that they have knee issues, that I can ask them, what does that mean by knee issues and what does that mean to you? Their answers, their understanding of what their pain represents can give us clues and avenues to educate and to explain or to refer out. We can change the way someone moves. That's beneficial. We can exercise. That's beneficial. We can break down movements and reintroduce, right? So we can take that squat and instead of going ass to grass and it's either this way or no way, we can break down that movement. They may not experience their pain until halfway through the movement. So we can squat them halfway and we can slowly reintroduce the total movement as they adapt and find comfort. And that movement is no longer threatening. So it gives us this understanding that we're not doing more damage. Exercise is helpful and beneficial, and the absence of movement and the absence of variation to movement may not be so helpful, may be in fact damaging. When we understand this stuff completely, we can provide a comforting, nourishing environment for our patients and our clients to perform at their best, at their highest level, and providing them a service that we wouldn't have been able to provide otherwise. If everything is just biological, mechanical input and mechanical output, then we're ignoring 2/3 of the story, And by understanding those two-thirds, we make ourselves more complete and our clients more complete.
Very good closing statement.
Thanks.
We're going to let the jury go back to their chambers and decide the the fate. Hopefully this for me at least, this did a much better job to help me understand a lot of this stuff, and I'm looking forward to getting into the books that John mentioned before. But I'm convinced that this stuff is really important for us to look at. If you're, you know, helping anyone or you're trying to help people, you're almost doing a disservice to them by not at least researching some of this stuff. Just grab one of the books, you know, for $10, right. $15, and at least start thinking about it.
Yep.
All right. So I think that's where we're going to wrap up. We do have a little bit of off-topic discussion where John did not see the Star Wars trailer until like right before or as we were recording. So he talks a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's really good, man.
And as always, you can make sure you can check out iTunes. Make sure you can. No, you can definitely check it out. But make sure you do go to iTunes and check out the Fitcast on there. And also you can follow myself on Twitter at Kevin Larrabee, and John is at John Fass. At Fitcast is also where you can get on Twitter if you want to be up to date on new guests that are coming up in terms of question requests and topic requests and even guest requests and stuff like that. Jump on there. And I think that is it. And like I said, thank you as always to everyone that is supporting the show through Patreon. And some of you guys are also helping out through PayPal. So thank you to everyone out there that is doing that. And I hope you find these shows valuable. And I hope you also take the time to jump on that website to help support us going forward. So, John, hope you have a great holiday if I don't talk to you. But
nice to you, my friend.
Of course, yeah, and this is, I mean, John's just getting, he's going to, like, literally fly from Saudi Arabia to New York City to get in line for Star Wars right now, so we probably won't be able to get to talk to him for a year unless you have good internet service from your cell phone, but, yeah, that's going to do it for us. Thank you, as always, to people that check it out, and we will catch you next time. Take care. All right, since we got John on, it's another old school off-topic section for those of you out there that miss it and want it. So John is still in the desert.
Still in the desert. No, well, still in the desert, but now I'm in Riyadh proper.
Whatever. Yeah. You know,
it's all
desert with water that was plumbed over there. so that's really cool.
It poured yesterday. It actually poured.
Does that not happen often?
Like once or twice a year it rains.
Wow.
Yeah, seriously.
So how do you guys get water out there? Do you just get it from other areas?
Desalination, take the salt out of the water, yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, pretty much. I believe that's how it's pretty much done. But Marianne and I were talking about this because she got out here in March, and it rained in March when she got here, and I think it's rained now twice since then.
Wow, did you drink the water out of the tap?
Hell no.
Okay, I was just checking.
I don't even – I give bottled water to my pets.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What are you guys up to now? You got one dog and two cats?
Three cats.
Three cats.
Yeah. Plus her three that are in Ireland right now.
So once you guys leave, you're going to be up to seven pets.
We're going to be the crazy cat lady from The Simpsons that just throws cats at people. That'll be us.
Wow.
Yeah.
Awesome.
All adopted. Please adopt your pets.
Yeah, and well, you've done it out of the kindness of your heart. It wasn't just like it's not even the want for pets. It was more just for, you know, the saving of the pets.
Right. There's a lot of homeless cats that are all over Saudi, but in the compound that we live on, there's a ton of them. But these are the fattest homeless cats you'll ever see because so many people like feed them and whatever. But there's like, I swear there's like four or five of them that Marianne and I look at and I'm like, honey, we can't take them in. I mean, you just want to take all these animals. It's horrible.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how different cultures or different populations will treat the strays. You know, there was an interesting story in like this university in China where there was this dog that always used to go to the classes, and the university poisoned the dog and killed it.
Oh, Jesus!
And threw the dog in the trash, and the kids like flipped out, like the students.
Yeah.
You know, understandably flipped out because this is a dog that used to just always hang out in the classes with them.
Oh my God.
So that's more just not in terms of China, but just that specific university, how they decided to treat that thing. But that's why if you have the opportunity to do it, and there's only usually three things that I ever donate money to. One is for the children's hospitals. Two is for Parkinson's research. And then third is for, you know, animal like no kill shelters and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And stuff like whenever I lose a bet with you, it ends up going to the Humane Society or something like that.
That's
so,
right.
It's all good. But on a happier note, now we're recording this on the day after that the new Star Wars trailer came out.
Oh my God! I need to see that as soon as we're done recording.
Okay. Well, it's
online.
Yeah, it's online.
God, I got to see that.
It's great. Maybe if you – do you have solid internet right now?
Yeah.
Well, we'll try pause it. The recording and we'll get live reactions. So we'll pause and we'll like be that. Back in 2 seconds. And we're back. John didn't watch it once. He watched it three times.
Watched it three times.
Three times back to back to back. And this is the trailer that just came out on the day after Thanksgiving. So
Teaser trailer.
Number. Yeah, there might be 30 seconds of actual footage from the movie.
Right.
But, you know, plenty to let you know what Abrams is going for and to let you know that he got the look right.
Oh, my God, did he get the look right. I mean, everything, it's retro. It's what the last three should have looked like.
Well, yeah, and the problem that I think the people have with the first three, their episode 1, 2, and 3, is that they looked too new. Like they like for technology from the past to look better than technology from, you know, 60 years in the future. But
that always happens on these like prequel remakes that end up having more technology than the originals did.
Yeah.
And that's what I think that Abrams did really well with the remakes of Star Trek.
Yeah.
Because it looks fairly retro without looking dated. And from the little bit that you can see in the trailer, that's exactly – I mean, he nailed it. Even the – you know, he's got these cool advances. And this takes place, you know, in the future of the series, but it still looks retro. It looks like the future of that universe.
Yep. Well, I mean, it's awesome. Easy when you invoke, you know, the same vehicles that were used in the previous series. You know, down to if you haven't seen the trailer, you should go watch it before you listen to any more of this. But you know, the X-Wings and the Millennium Falcon.
Right. If you remember like the first three in the series, episodes 1, 2, and 3, the third one became this dumbing down to make sense for the episodes 4, 5, and 6. The first two were more advanced than the third one in terms of look and like technology, which almost didn't make sense. It was you could appreciate it as it would therefore make sense into the continuum, but it made no sense otherwise. This looks like, from the little bit that you see, it's a continuation. What would this tech look like 30 years in the future? In the same way that, like, what are cars from 1980s, what would they look like today, right? It's not going to be something completely different, and it's not going to be reverse. It's going to be
Johnny
natural
Cab.
Progressions.
Yeah, Johnny What's Cab. That? Johnny Cab from Total Recall.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah. No, I think I couldn't give a crap about Star Wars, really.
How dare you?
But I'm much more of a Star Trek. I think Star Trek is a much better franchise and a much better universe. I think Star Wars is a little bit too much like Harry Potter, where Star Trek is a little bit more realistic.
Otter came out after Star Trek. How can you Star Wars? How can
no,
you?
No, I'm saying it's more fantasy. It's more like you
well,
know,
it's more fantasy.
It's unbelievable.
It's the future cowboy.
The Force, dude.
It's the Wild West in the future.
Metachlorians, magic. Like,
well, that was crap. You're basing on the first three might as well not have existed. Well, the first three episodes. I mean, there was just pure crap.
Yeah. Anyways, so you know, not to get into this whole argument, but I would even say I enjoy the Stargate franchise more than Star Wars. I think Star Wars has three great movies, and there's nothing. There's six and a half hours of great.
Screw this. The episode's over. I'm leaving.
6.5 hours are great. There's like 20 seasons of Star Trek that are fantastic.
Star Trek is fantastic, but you can't even compare them. The only comparison is because it's sci-fi. So people go, well, they were in a ship and these guys were in a ship, so I'll compare it.
Well, it's
completely
I'm just saying,
different.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying that people use that as a comparison. So that's why I'm saying that. I would even say Stargate. There's 17 awesome seasons of Stargate, and that's that. So we got like two more minutes for off-topic discussion. So I will say if people are into video game stuff, we've been having a great run of episodes on Back in My Play. If you like interviews with developers that created your favorite games from the past, like I've been interviewing guys that have been developing Nintendo games like from the NES and also Sega Genesis and Game Boy games. So it's been really cool. Of course, we also go back and look at old video games and revisit them and talk about our memories regarding them with people in the video game industry. So that has turned out to be surprisingly popular for the last year and a half or 2 years or so. No, year and a half. I don't know. Whatever. But that's fun, too. But we're going to talk about fitness in a second. So, John, you're probably excited. Are you going to go get in line?
Dude, I'm not even talking to you right now.
You're going to be like Macho Man. I'm not talking. Macho Man's so mad, he doesn't even want to talk. God. Macho Man, you got anything to say? I'm not talking.
I'm going to put on my Princess Leia hairpiece, and I'm right in line, man.
One other thing I will say, if you like pro wrestling, too, a great interview with CM Punk. No, I'm serious. There's a great interview with CM Punk on how terrible the WWE is and how horribly they treat their wrestlers and why he quit and why he's not going back. So I recommend looking for that. You can find it. It's all over the place. But even as someone that has come back to watching a lot of WWE stuff, it really makes me not want to support the product for how terrible that company is. It is as terrible as you think they would be to pro wrestlers and why you know, they basically just – I don't know. They're basically like every wrestler is a sprint. They basically just burn them out. And as soon as they're toast, they get rid of them. And since it's the only game in town these days, they can do that. So that's that. Let's record an episode.